It's totally fake news, made up fake. We went through the same stories. You could have asked me the same questions 4 years ago. I had to litigate this and talk about it. Totally fake news. Now, actually, I paid tax, but and you'll see that as soon as my tax returns. It's under audit. They've been under audit for a long time. The IRS does not treat me well. They treat me like the Tea Party, like they treated the Tea Party. They don't treat me well. They treat me very badly. You have people that in the IRS, they treat me very, very badly. But they're under audit. And when they're not, I would be proud to show, but that's just fake news.
The question is, what is income?
That was President Donald Trump on Friday afternoon responding to a New York Times article that detailed his tax returns over the past 15 years, concluding that he hadn't paid any federal income taxes in 10 of those 15 years, paid just 750 smackaroonies in both 2017 and 2016, wrote off massive consulting fees paid out to his own children, and owes hundreds of millions in loans that are due over the next 4 years. Hello, everyone. Matt Welch here, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly bull session about the news and culture, featuring my esteemed colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. A splendid Yom Kippur to you all.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
So, Catherine, let us start with this dual stipulation. One, like all bombshell stories about Trump, this is very unlikely to change public opinion or voter preference in any measurable way at all. And two, libertarians are less likely than most folks to view news events through the lens of that particular metric. So given that as background, what to you, Catherine, is a or the significant aspect of this New York Times article, if any?
I feel like the real hero here is Donald Trump's accountant. I mean, it's it's impressive in a way that someone with whom there has been so much back and forth about the tax return, that the thing that would finally come out in the end is like a thing we kind of already knew, which is that his empire has had its ups and downs and might maybe have had a down immediately before he decided to run for president. And also that if you work really hard at it, and if you are a rich person with a really inventive accountant, you can pay very little tax. And this is something that we've always known. Obviously, Trump is taking it to a particularly intense level here. But, you know, it seems clear to me reading the hella long New York Times piece on this and subsequent pieces to come, I understand, that most, if not all, of what he did was legal. And so, you know, as always, I would love to see a discussion about like, hey, is this what our tax code should look like? We will not be having that discussion. We will be having a totally different and stupider discussion about whether Donald Trump is an idiot child or evil genius, as always. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm just like super obsessed with details about like whether Trump ended up being able to benefit from, you know, very, very specific details that are like out of other broader political currents. So, you know, it seems like a big part of the story, for instance, is that he took advantage of a provision from the bailouts after the Great Recession that allowed income from canceled debt to be deferred for 5 years and then spread out. So like just that kind of thing is like, it's too complicated for the average American to like really understand or think about. It's probably too complicated to reasonably exist in many ways, but it's not illegal. And I will and always I do and always will stand up for tax minimization where possible.
I should hasten to add that it's too complicated for the average Reason Roundtable podcaster to understand. Nick, you were saying?
Yeah, sure. I was going to say that the one thing that I am amazed that I didn't see anywhere over Twitter on the weekend was that, you know, even Hitler paid his taxes. That's the one line of argumentation that I haven't seen. But I agree completely with Catherine that the accountant, you know, if only that was it a Ben Affleck movie called The Accountant, if only that was time to come out now. Because the accountant is the hero. He's the protagonist of this.
In that movie, Ben Affleck played an accountant who was also an autistic assassin by night. Just Want to clear that up here.
I like that, you know, that he's differently abled. You know, it really changes.
I actually want to further note
about assassins. Oddly, it kind of humanizes them.
Like a popular TikTok sound, which is people. It's a little like song about saying that you're an accountant when you actually have a job that you don't want to talk about, because there's no better way to end a conversation about your job than to say I'm an accountant. But I think at least this week that's not true. People are like, oh, you know, you're a tax accountant, like. You are the new hotness. Let's discuss.
Catherine, I didn't realize you were in bed with the red Chinese.
I think
I'm going to report you.
I love TikTok.
Yeah. Oh, God. She's sending data, probably data from this very podcast.
Beijing is listening to the podcast while it's being recorded. They like to get the advanced version.
On a vaguely serious note, I think the Trump story, which, you know, it's not going to change many people's minds. But at this point, you know, we're in the neighborhood where, you know, we're looking at all you have to, you know, everybody's trying to shave as you know, many votes or as few votes as they can in one direction or the other. And I could see this being the type of thing that kind of breaks people who are sick of Trump finally saying, like, I just can't anymore. I just can't. By the same token, in a larger sense for me, it is disturbing as hell. And we shouldn't like pass this away of saying that, like, okay, so you are, the tax code exists in a way where people who are making a lot of money can kind of get out of paying taxes that other people can't. People who are merely wealthier or, you know, upper middle class. And I, you know, that is, it's part and parcel of a long slide towards a hollowing out of the legitimacy of our, I think, of our institutions. And that's worth kind of thinking about. And, you know, just as a policy aside, I think in a lot of ways this, you know, if we properly frame the story, it's a strong, strong argument for some kind of consumption tax, something that would make it more difficult for, you know, taxes not to be felt kind of on an equal basis. So.
To that point, Peter, building on it, you know, Republicans, when they are competing in a presidential primary, which did not happen this cycle, but certainly did in 2015 and 2016, they are super duper fond of saying, I want all the taxes, the tax code to fit on a postcard. You know, they start talking about Steve Forbes's flat tax. And I've seen a lot
Matt, that was back when the post office was still in operation before it had been sold off as, you know, spare parts to Bain Capital.
Is an excellent real-time fact check. Thank you. But like, there's always this, like, well, what we really need is radical tax simplification. And I'm seeing a lot of that in response. I've seen Steve Forbes's name invoked more times in the last 24 hours than certainly since the last Freedom Fest. But Peter, that's not what happened when the Republicans went after the tax code this time around, is it?
Nope. It's not.
Thank you.
Look, Republicans do a lot of social spending through the tax code. And where Democrats just spend money by spending money, often money that doesn't, that has to be borrowed, or even money that you could say doesn't exist in some sense, Republicans often either do or attempt to do spending through the tax code. So all of the tax carve-outs that Republicans have signed off on over the years are, from a budgetary perspective, they are basically the same as spending. And so if you say that you reduce your tax liability by doing X activity, say by having a mortgage, then what you are doing is saying that you're paying less in taxes, and that is functionally the same, just from a kind of sheer budgetary math perspective, as saying we're going to give those people money. Now, there are libertarians who will make arguments that there's a big moral difference between letting people keep money they already have, and you know, and we could get into all of that. I don't think we need to, but just from a budgetary perspective, that is how a lot of the right has preferred to do social spending over the years. I think, you know, Catherine identified the hero of this story as the accountant. If there's a villain, it's the tax code itself. And the sheer complexity of the tax code is really what's on display here. Read that story. It is so long. It is so long. And it is admirably clear in for a piece about something so complex. But it is also still punishingly complex and kind of boring. I mean, especially you're 10,000 words in and it still looks like you've got another 10,000. This is, it's nearly a book, right? This should win the Hugo Award for best novella. It's a 15,000 word brief for tax code simplification. I don't think the New York Times intended it that way, but that's what came out of this, is that the tax code is absolutely insanely complex. And also that the IRS does completely crazy things when rich people are involved, like write rich people, this in this case, Donald Trump, like write them $73 million checks as rebates just because Trump just kind of asked for one and he provisionally qualified. And then it was, and then like the IRS rule is we'll adjudicate that later. And it was, but it was like a couple of month process. And he was just like, please give me $70 million. And they did. And then they're like, wait, that's a lot of money. Maybe we should go over that and make sure we did that right. And if there are two,
just imagine if he had Patriot in his name, he would have been right. Audited immediately.
No, and if there are two issues here, I think we're going to see a lot about, oh well, Trump is a criminal, Trump is a crook, he's a secret tax mastermind. He's not. That's the wrong way to look at this. I think there's definitely some kind of dubious intermingling of personal expenses with business expenses, and it looks like he is probably trying to use some of his personal expenses to offset business losses, which may or may not be completely legal, given that his business is himself, so it gets complicated. But the two things that actually stand out to me as real substantive issues are in some ways a little bit boring. One is that $72, $73 million refund, which is currently up for dispute with the IRS, and it has gone on hold, and the New York Times says it's not really sure why that process has stalled out. It seems pretty clear, or at least reasonable, to suppose that the reason it has stalled out is because it involves the president, and that makes things more complicated. And then the other thing is that Trump has several hundred million dollars in outstanding debt that's going to come due in the next 4 years. And that's just going to be a complicated sort of personal political issue where his debtors are going to have to decide whether or not to foreclose on the president of the United States, or potentially have to decide if Trump can't extend those loans or pay off those debts.
Catherine, let's build on that last bit, too. Does that matter to you? Should it matter to the American electorate or public citizenry that a president is leveraged to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, period?
I'm kind of torn on that. On the one hand, I think, you know, the scale and in particular the kind of international implications of some of his debt feels more relevant than it would be for someone to be just, say, in a lot of credit card debt when they rolled into the White House. At the same,
like Marco Rubio, remember?
Yeah, he bought a
right.
boat.
I mean, this is
he bought a boat, and it was like, yeah, kind of an,
Florida man a not, buys
a,
boat.
A nice
he
enough
can't
boat.
Afford.
He would be ducking out of strategy sessions to get that new offer where he could go another 3 months without paying anything.
On the other hand,
transferred his balance.
You know, the New York Times write-up, right at the top of the write-up, there's this, like, palpable disappointment in the sentence. You know, it's like, here's what's not in these returns. And then it says, nor do they reveal any previously unreported connections to Russia,
womp,
period.
Womp.
And it's just this, like, you just feel the agony of the person that had to write that sentence. And then, clearly, because they were looking so hard for Russia connections, there's, like, a big and actually kind of interesting chunk about the Miss Universe pageant or whatever in Moscow, mm-hmm. which seems, unlike many of these other things, to have actually been a somewhat profitable venture for Trump. So, you know, I think I get why this makes people wary. On the other hand, I am somewhat inclined to the school of thought that, like, you know, real estate in particular is governed by such an absurd and arcane, like, body of law and tax law. And then when you layer onto that the fact that Trump has just been, you know, he has a very weird business model, which is that he kind of makes actual money from being famous and then dumps it into things that make him look like a real businessman so that he can be more famous and make actual money and then dump it into the things that make him look like he's a real businessman. Like, that's clearly a vast oversimplification, but like, that's just an unusual business model. And so, you know, it's going to result in an unusual set of tax returns and an unusual financial kind of portfolio at any given moment. I'm not sure that there's any like special presidential or political risk there.
Nick, I think you can agree with me that the biggest reason to envy Trump in this is that he managed to get a $70,000 write-off for his hair as a male hair model. I'm sure you felt that. I tried to do that, absolutely. By the way.
You know, as somebody whose loyalty card at Supercuts is backed out. Matt Welch.
I literally tried to do that in 2014 when I was.
You know, you got to tell. You know, it's all there. It's all on his head. That's 70 true. Grand. You know, he didn't waste it on tips. I think part of this, this whole story, and again, I think it is outrageous. Not as much because Donald Trump, what a piece of garbage or anything, but it is like, man, this is just screwed up, that this kind of stuff happens in a way. But it's a distraction from all sorts of questions that have to do with like policy and what government is for. And, I think Peter has been hitting this note forever, really, at Reason, which is somewhere along the line, like policy went out the window, certainly when Trump was elected. But even before that, serious policy discussions had kind of gone missing. And I would be much more interested, we talk about, Trump is obviously bought by, the Russians who coaxed him into, who gave him a deal on prostitutes who would piss on a mattress. And we've got to find that mattress. And when we do that, everything's going to unravel. Instead of talking about what are our geopolitics with Russia, with other parts of the world? What are the policy implications of Trump's actual actions as opposed to the rhetoric and the circus and the denunciations around him? And this is more of that. And in a weird way, I'm really looking forward to the presidential debate because, you have two aging stumble bums entering the ring and anything could happen. I mean, this is better than anything Vince McMahon ever put together at wrestling. And now we're kind of like, what about this? And I want to hear these guys actually talk about the specific policies that they're going to enact or lie about enacting, as opposed to this, this kind of shadow pantomime of grief and despair and bullshit that constantly gets dragged into everything. And it's one of Trump's geniuses, because you still have people who are saying, oh, he's a government, he's a small government guy. He cut government, unlike Biden, who will grow it. I would love to have a reality-based discussion about Trump's actual presence.
Catherine,
there's a sense in which the Times piece provides us with detail filling out something we already knew, which is that Trump doesn't pay income taxes. He has said this. He has bragged about it for years. And what the Times did with their incredible and valuable investigation here was to confirm that when Trump bragged about not paying income taxes in 2016, he wasn't lying.
Which is a reasonable thing to have to stop and check, given that Trump brags about a lot of things that don't 100% pan out. Now, of course, when asked, as we heard in the clip at the top of the show, hey, is this true that you like legit really didn't pay any income taxes? He, was immediately like, no, it's fake news. So there are wheels within wheels here. And in his defense, he did pay a lot of taxes. As someone who is constantly getting extensions on my taxes and sending weird checks for random amounts for my quarterly returns and then having it all reverse itself in the end, like, he paid a lot in taxes. He just got it all back. And you know what? That's another thing that's really screwed up about the American tax system, is that even for average Joes, for regular people, the concept of the tax return is a common and familiar one, and it shouldn't be. It should not be that tons of Americans randomly get a check after sending in a bunch of paper to the government because they did a bad job of calculating their tax liability in advance. The reason they did a bad job of calculating the tax liability in advance is because our definition of taxable income is wildly and insanely baroque and needs to be simplified. I mean, it's not, I actually think, the Republicans talking about the postcard tax return is one thing, but actually all of this is prior to that, right? Like, all of this is not about whether we have a flat tax or, you know, progressive, you know, tax progressive rates in different brackets. It's about what is income. And that's what Trump has effectively won the fight on in his taxes. He just says, like, well, I had income, but I had losses. And so what are you going to do about it?
I wish, Catherine, that before you said the phrase, what is income, that we heard a sound.
The question is, what is income? What?
Like that. We need more.
Sure.
What is? Sure.
We need more stoner.
I mean,
what does that even mean?
We need more Elon Musk stoner.
We absolutely
vibe.
Do. I strongly agree.
Okay.
This is.
I thought you were crankling cellophane. I didn't realize you were. Yeah.
I would have done I should have done the universal bong sound. Which is,
wow! Please sense. Never make that sound there in my ears again.
What? Listen, we are on audio man. Only. On
you know what's
this,
what the so, worst part is? He didn't make that noise with his mouth. It was a different body part.
I'm the Les Blank, the Mel Blank of this podcast. since Nick teased Les Blank. Great, great documentary.
Yeah, no, that's like a different kind of blank. You belong to the blank generation, man.
I wish I could do a Foley sound right now of me walking away. Like I was trying to take off my shoes and get that done before.
That's not what shoes sound like.
They are. That's what a horse sounds mud, like. I think. Like that was quicksand shoes.
So is there mud in Nick our podcast teed up booth now?
Yeah, things are bad at the office, guys.
Matt Welch, you were about to try and get us back on track, not unlike Donald Trump with the American economy.
Thank you, Nick. And also thank you for teeing up a discussion about the presidential debate, which occurs tomorrow night. We're recording this on Monday. You're hopefully listening to this on Monday, like faithful listeners that you are. Tuesday night, it's a two-man debate. Nick used the phrase grief, despair, and then I will parenthesize BS for Fred Young. But so on one side of this debate preview here, we have the president of the United States over the weekend tweeting, quote, I will be strongly demanding a drug test of sleepy Joe Biden prior to or after the debate on Tuesday night. His debate performances have been record setting uneven, to put it mildly. Only drugs could have caused this discrepancy. And then this morning, the president tweeted, quote, Joe Biden just announced that he will not agree to a drug test. Gee, I wonder why. On the other side of this,
that is three dimensional trolling.
Joe Biden, in an interview with MSNBC over the weekend, said Trump is, quote, sort of like Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels, in that you say the lie long enough, keep repeating it, repeating it, repeating it. It becomes common knowledge. So Catherine, we deserve this, right?
Yes, we do. This is the debate we deserve. Now, first of all, I would love for these dudes to get as much performance enhancing medication into their ancient bodies as they can. I feel this way about the Olympics as well, just for the record. Like, everybody should be doping all the time, please. Like, we need better performance from our presidents and our athletes.
I want chromosome tests.
No, I mean,
before the debate.
We do a little bit of planning for these podcasts. Sometimes at the end of last week, we tried to plan the podcast. Then we realized we were going to have to actually completely pivot to talking about the Supreme Court nomination. But now we have completely pivoted to talking about taxes. Like, they announced the topics for this debate on September 22nd. And like, all of news and all of the presidency and all of everything has changed since then. So, you know, on some level, I don't even know what I'm hoping to see in this debate, because there could be a whole nother news cycle between then and now that they'll need to address. One of the topics that is like steadily being pushed down the list is, well, it's listed on the official Commission for Presidential Debates site as race and violence in our cities, which is an interesting framing. But I would like them to talk about that a little bit. I mean, there was this moment where it was like, oh, Trump is running against the Democratic mayors of cities that are in flames rather than Biden, because that's an opponent he can really beat. I would like to see some of that on the stage, because I do think, unlike Donald Trump's taxes, that is a question that actually matters to people. And also that people are getting increasingly kind of outlandish views on in both directions. And I would like to see these two people who are supposed to be the representatives of our two mainstream parties speak about those issues in a way that highlights the differences.
And both of those candidates, I think, interestingly on that issue, are fundamentally schizophrenic. At the Republican convention, Trump and Trump World was out there saying, my God, these cities, you know, Blue Lives Matter, this is terrible. And then the other, they were dinging Joe Biden for his fingerprints all over every, you know, draconian crime bill in the history of the United States, which is true. And Biden the same way. He's the criminal justice reformer, and he's also like, I'm not the socialist. I like cops. I'm funding them. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays
out. And the idea of
off.
Like somehow it's both of their faults or neither of their faults that the inner cities are burning. Which first of all, they're not for the most part. In a way that
mostly is, peaceful. Is that what you're saying?
It's mostly peaceful. I am saying that. Like, I actually really like, you know, as people who live in cities on this podcast, like I'm finding it increasingly notable and troubling that even, you know, my family that lives in the suburbs of the city that I live in has this image of what it's like to be downtown right now that's not accurate.
They just don't want to visit you anymore,
that's
Catherine.
That's fair.
That's they're
cool.
Saying, like, oh, you know, I'd go in, but come on.
It's cool, man. But like...
the windows on my favorite tiki bar are still boarded up.
Right.
See?
Right. So like clearly, I don't mean to say like nothing is going on. Obviously, there's some major movements going on in these cities and some of it is violent. But I think the idea of like, you have to reelect Donald Trump because elsewise our cities will burn is like, But
Nick, let's focus on our.
I am looking forward. Yes, Matt, I am looking forward to Donald Trump seating Hunter Biden and his bastard kid from Arkansas in his family section. I think it's going to be a bold move.
Let's talk about the fact that there's two grumpy old men only from the major parties on stage. We have the Libertarian candidate, Joe Jorgensen, is on all 50 ballots plus one.
Where we could have a less cranky, kind of cheerful, early 60s woman and however old Howie Hawkins, the Green Party candidate, who also could conceivably win. He's on the ballot in enough states to get 270 electoral votes. I think that should be the test by which candidates are invited or not to the
to
debates.
All of them or just the first one?
If you could plausibly win. If you could plausibly get 270 votes, or not plausibly, if you could technically get 270 electoral votes, you should be on that stage.
So you can draw the line at Gloria La Riva
and they are
Rocky
not.
De La Fuente? Not enough.
They're not going to make it. Neither would Kanye West. These are national parties that have an actual influence on what happens. And I think they deserve to be on those stages. And to get to your point, Matt, if I may, instead of having Statler and Waldorf up there alone, you know what? Why not throw in a Ramada Inn and a Motel 6 or something on the stage? Like, who loses from that? It would be great. And
what
I would
like
to see
that. And I'll throw this to Suderman. What do you think would be talked about? Because Suderman, you're the guy who points out, as Nick observed earlier, that policies just kind of has vanished in a lot of politics. What do you think we would hear about if we had a Green and a Libertarian on stage that we would not otherwise hear about?
Well, I certainly think that if we had a Libertarian on stage, we'd hear a lot more about spending and a lot more about the debt and the deficit. And that may come up. There is a section on the Trump and Biden records that's supposed to lead the night, and then another section on the economy. But in general, that's not something that either Trump or Biden make much of. And in the press doesn't that much either. It's just not that big a focus for mainstream press at this point. I mean, what you want out of a debate like this is a contest of ideas. You want competing visions for the country. You want a sense of how these guys would govern. It's not quite a job interview, but it's a little bit like a job interview in which they're not just asking to do the job. They're explaining how they would do it, how they view the job of the president, and what his or her role is supposed to be. And what we're going to get instead is, you know, not just Statler and Waldorf, but like a Statler and Waldorf death match, right? It's going to be like a two men enter. I mean, I guess they're both going to leave. But right? It's right?
Two half men enter.
You know, it's,
two old men
it's
enter.
It's a sequel to Grumpy Old Men. It's the Odd Couple, but for the most powerful political office in America. It's Cocoon in reverse, right? Except like instead of jumping into the pool and they all get younger, like they're going to to get on stage and suddenly age in real time. And like, any, it's just going to be what I really want is some good memes. That's it. I just want some good memes.
I would like, you know, what's missing too, though, and you know, we've been bitching and moaning about the way debates are done, you know, for decades, really, at Reason, but like a really good moderator, because this does come down to, like, I would love to see Donald Trump, you know, be forced by somebody like Intelligence Squared's John Donvan, or, you know, or somebody like C-SPAN's Brian Lamb, like, so, you know, like really fantastic interviewers, even somebody like Terry Gross. I would love to see an interview that's a different format, and that is not a tit for tat. You get a rebuttal and hold up your whammy card and all of that kind of crap. But, Trump's spending record is abysmal. And I would like to have somebody like lay it out in a chart and say, like, what are you going to do differently the next time? Biden is what? He's proposing something like $3.5 trillion in new taxes over the next 10 years and as much as $11 trillion in new spending. Like, just talk about that. Like, and, you know, and obviously I find that ruinous, but other people might not. But just what are you thinking with that? Like, and where do you make up the difference in all of that kind of stuff? Like, to have an actual discussion rather than a fake debate. You know, if I may, a bit of a history lesson. There was the first televised debate, presidential debate between Kennedy and Nixon in 1960. For a variety of reasons, there was no televised presidential debate until 1976, when Gerald Ford realized he was going to lose to Jimmy Carter, so he assented to have one. At the beginning of that debate, the cameras stopped working. There were technical difficulties, and the two idiots stood on a darkened stage for 15 minutes while the networks were desperate to try and get stuff working again. The next day on the Today Show, Marshall McLuhan, and can you imagine, like, in today's world, like having Marshall McLuhan on the Today Show for like a 15-minute segment with Edward Newman, if anybody remembers him, and a young Tom Brokaw. He talked about how the technology revolted against being abused by such a crummy debate format that would elucidate no meaning, no interest, no anything, that they went on strike. And it's like, you know, enough with these debates. They really do not elucidate anything. They don't include everybody. They don't advance a serious discussion about policy. And it's such a frustrating and missed opportunity. It's a good thing it only happens every 4 years.
I will say the moderator for this week's debate is Chris Wallace of Fox News, who is not a hack, and who has interviewed Trump in ways that that are quite revealing, I think, and where he has, you know, offered useful, not tendentious, fact checking in real time, asked President Trump to respond. You know, it's basically, you know, things like, here, this is a graph showing your performance, showing the country's performance with regard to coronavirus. This is what is actually happening, and gotten, I think, some useful information or answers anyway out of President Trump, and helped us see how he thinks.
Catherine, is it possible, though, that we here and journalists and or libertarians and or whoever pays too much attention to this stuff are, in our preferences for what we'd like to see at the debate, reflecting our own kind of narrow bubble that isn't shared, and I know that makes a lot of sense, with a lot of other people. It's not necessarily the way that consumers consume or respond to politics. A lot of people would say, I'm just looking, my job interview is purely a sense of someone's personality, whether I like it or not. Maybe there's value in that. Like, I can, you know, you can respond to someone's personality, will give you a better idea of how they govern, perhaps, than their list of policy white papers.
Yeah, I mean, we've been making, I would say, even more jokes than usual about the ages of the two candidates on this podcast, which always makes me slightly nervous. Like, I'm here for the generational warfare, but I'm not here for, like, this individually targeted ageism necessarily, though I feel it in my heart a little. But the reason for that digression is to say, I think in other races, the debates are genuinely kind of a way for Americans to meet the candidates. And in those circumstances, the personality gut check, have a beer with thing matters more. And I get that. But first of all, America knows Donald Trump. America has known Donald Trump for a very long time. And the same is true with Biden, although it's a slightly different demographic of people who know him. But So I think that's that should be less true here. It should be less true that what we're doing at this point is like checking these dudes out and like doing a vibe check, as the kids say. We should be able at this point, given the long careers and long records of these guys, to talk about something with a little more substance. And, you know, in talking about substance, you can also do the vibe check. Like, these things are not mutually exclusive. They shouldn't be, especially not for a president of the United States. So, you know, I get that not everyone is like rolling into these debates being like, I'm going to need some specific information about your climate change plan. But those people can get the information they're looking for while we also do the climate change plan conversation. And that would be my preferred equilibrium, which I cannot have and never will have.
I will. Oh, I was going to say, you know, in the past, it was always which, you know, Americans vote for the guy they want to have a beer with. But on tomorrow's stage, it'll be two teetotalers who are also geriatrics. So it'll be which Americans want to open an Ensure bottle
in a special place
for their candidate.
We're fortunate to have Suderman on this podcast. We like to take advantage of that fact to talk about things that
I like being taken advantage of.
You know, that reduces our pleasure in taking advantage of you, Peter. It's very selfish of you.
So this also involves occasionally things that were news 75 news cycles ago, yet only 24 to 48 hours back. And that includes, if I'm not mistaken, the president late last week and even over the weekend, I think, was hyping an executive order having to do with like pre-existing conditions and healthcare and whatnot. Suderman, you follow this stuff. Can you just give us a quick brief as to what, if anything, the president did or announced his intention of doing that would affect anything having to do with health policy in the United States of America? Go.
In the end, all politics in America are healthcare politics, is my theory, and it usually works out. It certainly is here. So one of the big attack lines that Joe Biden is launching against Amy Coney Barrett, who is Trump's Supreme Court nominee, who we basically haven't even talked about this episode, is that she is going to be, if she gets confirmed here before the election, then she is going to be part of the Supreme Court when they hear the latest challenge to Obamacare, which the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear a week after the presidential election. So that has brought healthcare back into the news. And of course, it has brought questions to Trump. Hey, man, you've been saying we want to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something else, TBD, pretty much since you started running for president. So what is your plan going to be? Because Trump has been saying for at least a year now, I'm going to have a new plan in 2 weeks. I'm going to have a new plan in 2 weeks. I'm going to have a new plan in 2 weeks. That plan has never come out. So on Thursday, they said, we're announcing the plan. And the plan was an executive order that says we are going to protect pre-existing conditions. That executive order has no mechanism attached to it. And it's not really clear that it has any force of law at all. It's almost entirely symbolic. So you can't say what he would be doing or how. It's like an executive order that just declares that all watermelons will be seedless.
In favor. Here for it.
I can't even remember the last time I bought a seeded watermelon.
Americans will vote for that. And who the hell knows how we are going to make it happen? And so that is the extent of the executive order. It's a total nothing burger. It is kind of disingenuous, kind of nonsense. And then Trump followed that up with a further announcement saying, look, seniors, I'm going to be giving 33 million Medicare beneficiaries a $200 prescription drug gift card. So that adds up to a little less than $7 billion. It's not at all clear how that's going to be paid for. They're saying it's through the Medicare's demonstration program, but Medicare demonstration programs are supposed to be expected revenue neutral in the end. They're also for innovations, not for what clearly amount to election year bribes. It's also not clear if these gift cards are actually going to go out at all or if they're going to go out before the election, because administration officials are being really cagey about how or if this is going to work at all. Meanwhile, there's still that lawsuit in, you know, sort of looming after the election. And the Trump administration has made the unusual decision to not defend a federal law. Usually the administration defends a federal law in court and instead says they want all of Obamacare to be struck down, including the pre-existing conditions rule. So Trump is simultaneously backing a lawsuit to get rid of the pre-existing conditions regulations in Obamacare and also promising that he will always protect pre-existing conditions without naming any mechanism. Now, you can say those pre-existing conditions rules that are in Obamacare create problems. They make health insurance substantially more expensive. On the other hand, if you're going to say, I'm going to protect pre-existing conditions, it is reasonable to ask, how are you going to do that? What does that mean? Why are you in court attacking the rules that many people would say do protect pre-existing conditions? It's a little more complicated than that because they actually, in some ways, create incentives for insurers to try and not cover people who have expensive pre-existing conditions and raise costs for the rest of us. It's a huge, tangled mess, and no one, but in particular Donald Trump, is just not in any way talking straight on this, not offering any sort of a coherent theory or plan. He is the apotheosis of Republican empty stupidity on healthcare, of 10 years of this, of saying, we don't like Obamacare. Well, what do you want to do instead? Well, we don't like Obamacare.
I think I saw apotheosis open up for yes on the 90125 tour. That was a high watermark. Suderman just talked about the Supreme Court nomination, Catherine. So let's have a quick lightning round on that. Amy Coney Barrett. And I can't believe I got that right.
I'm very proud
Thank
of you.
It's really Thank it, you.
It's yeah. not easy. ACB.
Now try John Paul Stevens, Matt.
Cannot do it. There's yeah. no way. The okay. president nominated her over the weekend on Saturday. She's up for it. Lindsey Graham, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, announced a timetable. They're going to try to cram this in before the election in the waning days of this election year. Last week, we talked about this at length. Please go listen. It's great. And I think the overall vibe, and don't dispute my characterization here, was that, yeah, dudes, they have the right to do that. And that's the normal thing that for the Senate to do. So my question in a lightning round format here, beginning with Catherine, is, yes, they have the right and the responsibility to do this. But is this a good idea to go in a semi-unusually fast process in the waning days of a hotly contested presidential election, Catherine Mickey Ward?
I basically just am kind of burned out on the process question. I don't know if it's a good idea. I think it matters very much what the second and third order backlashes to that idea are. I think the idea itself, like, I don't think it's a reasonable question to ask, you know, might Republicans have eschewed this path? They were always going to do this. I genuinely believe Democrats would do it in their place. And so I think the more interesting question is a 6-3 court, although is it really a 6-3 court? Supreme Court justices have such a way of screwing over the people who appointed them in like 18 different directions, which is something I love about the Supreme Court. But is a court with this many Trump appointees going into a potentially contentious election and or Trump second term good for freedom, good for free minds and free markets? I'm not so sure. I mean, I don't have a particularly lot of faith that if Biden won and got to appoint Ruth Bader Ginsburg's successor, that I would be terribly keen on who he would pick. So I don't know. I think ACB seems okay. And I'm particularly outraged. I know we're not really talking about it right now, but I just want to flag how super duper outraged I am at how stupid the coverage has been around both her faith and her choice to adopt children. Like, screw everyone for that business.
Has it really been coverage, though, or has it been?
Come on,
Twitter.
Come on, Catherine. We have to ask. We have to ask. Just imagine how far Amy Coney Barrett would have gone if she didn't.
I am going to mute.
She could have been so much more
Handmaid's
successful
Tale,
if only her faith didn't get in the way.
I cannot handle it.
The coverage of this stuff is insane.
It is Matt, the coverage of her and her faith and the way, you know, that really it is, you know, these goddamn
Catholics.
There
are too many on the Supreme Court. Come on.
You know, they have that. I agree. There were, you know, and there were too many New Jerseyans on the Supreme Court. So we're, you know, we're getting some balance, but I think the coverage of her so far, we have, I think the question that Catherine is asking is the most important one, which is from a libertarian perspective, is having her on the court, you know, a win for limited government and individual autonomy? I don't know. You know, when you compare that to like whoever Joe Biden picks, she's probably different in the ways that she will impinge on individual autonomy. I also am really annoyed that, you know, like why aren't we just talking about abortion? Because that's what everybody, that's what's the subtext for all of this. And it's also clear that like state legislatures and the federal government or whatever, like let's settle the abortion issue because we've been living with abortion laws that have been more or less in place, since 1973. A vast majority of people want to keep abortion as it is or expand it a bit more. That's the clear majority of people in America. Can we just settle that issue and get on with other questions, including if you are anti-abortion, figure out ways to change the culture so that, and the technology, the reproductive technology, so abortion happens less often, which is in fact what has been happening for
maybe,
the past 20 years.
This means that it is settled, right? If the compromise is the compromise and it's just like arguing around the edges and then also creating this great kind of almost Potemkin or symbolic and just deeply, deeply felt battle over a thing that never happens exactly. Not that abortion never happens, but that either, you know, it's all abortions for everybody, American flags for everybody else, or, you know, it's Handmaid's Tales.
Muted.
Maybe that's what?
I'm muting you. We're done now.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Anyways, yeah, I both agree with you, and I also wonder if, like, our messy status quo is actually a sign that the question has been, in its way, settled.
The podcast last week that somebody joked about, you know, maybe we should just have like an abortion court and then a Supreme Court for everything else? Like, I'm really feeling that lately.
That's
like,
Connor Friedersdorf's idea.
Oh, that's Connor's thing. I'm here for it. Like, let's just have like a body about which the executive and the legislature can go to war to populate the abortion court however they want. They can like burn all their energy over there, and then meanwhile, we'll just have another court for everything else. I think that's a good solution.
Let's go to our end of podcast cultural consumption. I will start this time because I saw something that is of interest and participated in it too. It's a new documentary from our friends at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, Nico Perino. They have a new thing coming out October 9th called The Mighty Ira, a civil liberties story. It's a documentary about the life and times of Ira Glasser, who was the executive director of the ACLU from 1978 to 2001, and during which probably the most kind of famous or notorious, depending on how you look at it, case was right at the beginning of his chairmanship, is when the Skokie case came down, where the ACLU defended the right of these LARPing Nazis in Chicago to march in a neighborhood that's overwhelmingly Jewish, that included a whole lot of people who were Holocaust survivors. It's a very interesting documentary, a period of contentious free speech, a lot of kind of commentary on violence in the streets, both back in the 70s and also in Charlottesville and elsewhere. And it portrays, from Ira Glasser's point of view, that there should not be any tension between struggling for racial equality, which is what got him into politics, and at the same time defending the free speech of the biggest racists you can imagine, that these are all contiguous in a very kind of Jonathan Rauchian way. It's of interest, I believe. My conflict of interest is that I did a post-game interview. So this thing is available on Angelica Film Centers. I'm sure I'm botching that. Thank you. Via a virtual a cinema, and then right afterwards, you'll see a 20-minute Q&A I did with follow-up with Ira Glasser about various things, including whether he thinks the ACLU would do a Skokie now. And to preview the answer a little bit, not so sure. But anyways, check it out. Nick, what have you been consuming?
I watched, partway through the Hulu series, A Wilderness of Error. It's based on Errol Morris's book of the same name, which is a long, detailed look at the Jeffrey McDonald fatal vision case. McDonald was a doctor in the early 70s, a Green Beret Army doctor whose wife and two children were killed. He was also injured in an attack he says was done by hippies who were trying to get drugs from him. He was cleared by the Army, ultimately convicted of something like three lifetime sentences, became the subject of a very contentious and controversial book by the fabulous journalist Joe McGinnis. Morris's take on this, which comes out in the book and then through the documentary, is that almost everything involved in the journalistic and kind of legal narrative falls apart, upon closer and closer examination. Morris is fantastic as a documentarian, and this book is particularly interesting for people who find the way that journalists and media cover stories and create a narrative, which is as opposed to following the facts, like where a narrative, where a story becomes so appealing in its kind of storyline and arc and character arc and tragedy or comedy or whatever, that they begin to dismiss mere facts as kind of complications and things that get in the way of telling a good story. It's a fantastic meditation on how media chooses, kind of story shape, genre form over what actually seems to have happened. Highly recommended. And I'll also just put a plug in for Hulu, which I finally broke down and bought a subscription to. And Catherine, I may mention The Handmaid's Tale.
Muted.
So mute yourself. Yeah. Even a couple of months ago, I was like, I am not paying for Hulu. I'm not paying for Hulu because I already am like paying for 50 million other things. What a fantastic streaming service. The content, not only do they have Seinfeld, which is enough, that's worth like $7 a month with ads, but I've been also watching the late lamented show, Difficult People, which is phenomenal. It is absolutely the meanest, funniest show, and I wish it was still on air.
Catherine, we kind of foreshadowed your pick. Tell us about it.
So I started listening to the new Kara Swisher New York Times podcast, which is called Sway. I have not previously been a Swisher fangirl, though there are, she is like a wildly prolific podcaster. Like, she's had a podcast on all the things for all the time. She's like somehow has a podcast at New York Magazine and a Vox one, and she's just everywhere podcasting.
New York Magazine and Vox are the same thing.
Yeah, that's true. But they were two different podcasts somehow. There were like multiple, they're everywhere. So this is a new one. So I thought I would start fresh. She's a pretty good interviewer. A little like I like the slight, like slightly over aggressive interviewer tone. Like, I'm here for it. She interviewed Elon Musk for one of her debut pods, which shows you the kind of juice that she has. Just also casually picking up Gavin Newsom. You know, no big deal. I just want to play y'all a little bit of her Musk interview because it really, like, genuinely brought joy to my heart. So here you go.
If you got a two-party system, then the problematic issues are going to kind of fall somewhat randomly into one party or the other. It's not clear to me that there's a cohesive set of reasoning why these things are in one party versus another. They seem semi-random. And, you know, obviously I'm, like, socially very liberal and then economically right of center, maybe, or center. I don't know. Obviously not a communist. So I think we want to keep improving the system, but we want a system that is responsive to the people. And all capitalism really means is just making products that people want.
So basically what I'm saying is any podcast that lets Elon Musk say that thing for a minute in the middle is a good podcast by me. There's also, by the way, a Blue Origin launch this week. So just like a good week for space billionaires and a good podcast if you want to learn more about them.
Every week is a good week for space billionaires.
It's so true, Matt. It's so true. Never, like you said that, like, har har, but like, it's true.
Suderman, are you too going to play 100% in character?
I think with all this discussion of the muted Margaret Atwood book and associated Hulu series, I really think that's the wrong way to think about the future. We're headed towards Oryx and Crake, which is, you know, a post-viral world in which there's like one human left surrounded by genetic mutants who may or may not be constructed out of like some parts of human DNA. And that seems a much more likely future than the thing that we shall not say. I watched the movie Antebellum, which is a horror film directed, the debut film from filmmakers Gerard Bush and Christopher Renz. It stars Janelle Monáe, who is an excellent, excellent sort of sci-fi inflected pop singer. And the movie, unfortunately, is not excellent. It is a social horror film, and I think that that's a perfectly reasonable thing for a horror film to be. Horror in particular has always kind of melded social commentary with genre. But this movie doesn't have... It just doesn't have much to say about anything. There's almost no story. There's almost no kind of connecting thread. There's just an opening sequence set on a plantation run by Confederate soldiers in which you see in extended and graphic detail that slavery is really and truly awful. And then there's another sequence set in the present day in which Janelle Monáe, who had previously played a slave at the center of the plantation, is now, now we see her in her contemporary life as a successful author. And of course, we're supposed to understand that there's a connection between the present day person played by Janelle Monáe and the slave played on, you know, by her on this plantation. The connection, I'm not going to spoil it here, even though I did in my review, but the connection, you can probably figure it out just from the film's opening quote, the William Faulkner line, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." And the whole movie is just sort of a one note twist explication on that line that doesn't have anywhere else to go and just isn't all that engaging, is kind of difficult to watch. In fact, I'm not the only person who has said this. You know, there's a very good piece about this at Vulture, which is New York Magazine's pop culture vertical, just about what sort of how unpleasant the movie is and how much it sort of comes across as thinking it's saying something really big and important, when what it's doing in a lot of ways is indulging in exactly the sort of brutality that it aims to critique. It's just unfortunately not a very good film. And I think that there's a real issue when filmmakers aim for social relevance and forget how to make a movie in the process.
Boom. Thank you, Peter. And thank you, everyone, for listening to the Reason Roundtable. Check out all Reason podcasts over at reason.com/podcast. Nick, what do you got up on the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesday? Do you know?
We're going to be talking with positive psychologist Scott Barry Kaufman about how to transcend your mere meager lives and climb up the Maslow pyramid.
I can finally get out of this basement, crawl through the...
Yeah, you can try, Matt. I mean, you'll fail, but remember, failure is part of a larger failure that we call life.
That's beautiful. Thank you. We'll see you next week.
Boy, we really did need the bong hit sounds all over this episode.
Did. Should we? If we could just duplicate those, like, periodically throughout the episode.
Yeah, Ian, just intersperse them, like those NPR reports where it's always just someone talking in a hushed voice, and then there's the sound of tea being made in the background. It's right, like, but we need that for, but, yeah. Birds, maybe, right? I love NPR sound effects.